preserving Maine's islands and coast. Maine's coastline is 3,500 miles long, much of it on islands. Maine's islands and beaches and rocky cliffs and working waterfronts are treasured gems, but they are also at risk. Climate change and development pressures threaten future coastal access. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Less than 15% of Maine's coast is conserved, and the vast majority is closed off from public use. But nonprofit organizations, local and state governments, and landowners are working together to change that. The Maine Coast Heritage Trust is wrapping up a major $125 million campaign to preserve and protect more of Maine's coast. We'll learn how it and other organizations prioritize what parcels are most important to preserve and what some of the challenges are. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Maine's coast and islands are particularly vulnerable to climate change and other threats. Today, we're going to discuss changes underway to protect and preserve these lands, as well as ways to increase recreational and commercial access. Joining me in the studio, Angela Twitchell, who is chair of the Maine Land Trust Network, and Tim Glidden, he's president of the Maine Coast Heritage Trust. As always, we want to hear from you. Do you live on one of Maine's islands? Is one of Maine's islands precious to you? Are you concerned about the future outlook for islands and the coast? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Welcome to you both. Tim, I knew that Maine had a lot of islands, but I didn't know how many until today, until I was reading through some of the material from the Maine Coast Heritage Trust. Why don't you tell us, one, how many islands there are in Maine? Tell us about them as well. How many are large? How many are small? How many developed, undeveloped? What's the picture out there?
Well, Jennifer, first, thank you for having us on. It's a pleasure to be here. That's an answer that I would not have known before I started on this job myself. Maine actually has 2,400 islands larger than an acre.
2,400
islands.
Off the coast, or does that include islands and lakes?
This would be islands off the coast.
Okay.
So a lot more when you add in all the islands on the lakes of Maine. Many of those, probably most of those, are quite small, but there's about 1,800 of those that are undeveloped islands. And they really represent one of the sort of key characters of what makes Maine so special. People have been visiting this coast for hundreds of years, and of course we had many, many people living here for many thousands of years before that. The Maine islands have been important to people for its entire history. Maine Coast Heritage Trust has conserved about 300 of those.
When you say undeveloped, what is the definition of undeveloped? Is that there was never a structure there, it's always been wild, or is it one house on a 3-acre island would be considered undeveloped? How do you define it?
That's a great question. It would mean that there's currently nothing on those islands now, but in the past, there may well have been something on those islands. Many of Maine's islands were used for keeping sheep. There were islands right here in Portland. There were islands used for drying fish. So there's been a lot of development on the islands over the years, but we're now down to a much smaller group of actually inhabited islands with real live, vital communities on them today.
I was also really interested to learn that not only Maine's islands, but Maine's coastline, compared to other states, we do not have much public access.
That's a key point that I hope all of your listeners take away from today. Maine overall has only about 6.5% of its land area in some form of public ownership, and that's much, much lower than the states just all around us. We're at about 6.5%. Maine land trusts have stepped into that gap as a way to address that concern, to keep the real special character of the state that we know and love. And that's particularly true on the coast.
Well, Angela, bringing you into the conversation now, coastal land as well as inshore land. I know today we're talking about the coast and islands, but this idea that Maine has less conserved land than other New England states, is that because of Maine's long tradition of public access to private land?
I think that's a big part of it. And I also think, you know, I'm from Maine. We all live in Maine. And there's a strong ethic of local control. And I think that's how we ended up having 84 land trusts. We like our land conservation to be local and to have some local say in the conservation that we do. So while many other states, you know, out west and other places have a large percentage of publicly owned land, federal or state-owned land, in Maine we have less of that. And more conservation that's done locally through land trusts and municipalities as well.
I understand the comparison to out west, but even compared to other New England states.
It's really true, yes. If you look at the numbers, even for New Hampshire, which you think a lot like Maine, they have quite a bit more public land than we do here in Maine.
So there's the public land, but then there's also the land that has been conserved so far, and Maine is also behind other New England states in that measure as well, right?
That's correct. Tim, you had the numbers. In Maine, I think, including all conserved land, we're at about 20% conserved now, which is a great improvement over a couple of decades ago. And in New Hampshire, was it around, it was higher than that?
It is much higher than that. The way I tend to think of it is that, you know, Maine represents about half of New England. Maine's a big state in New England. And yet, the other New England states have more conserved land than Maine does. So there's, you know, that's where all the people are. That's where a lot of the conserved land is. And as we look at the future of Maine, which is, you know, we all love this state very, very much. We're very lucky to have what we have. We're quite concerned that there'll be changes coming in the future, especially as climate warms the places to the south, and we're going to see a lot more people.
Well, and this is of course, one of the big questions here. I was going to ask, with this long tradition of public access to private land, why is it so important to have the land change hands from private ownership and then go into some sort of trust, whether it's a land trust or public ownership, in your view?
Well, I think we want to be careful because not all of the land that's conserved actually leaves private ownership. So much of the land that's conserved by both of our organizations and the many other land trusts in Maine is conserved through the use of conservation easements. And just a quick sidebar, that's just an agreement, a voluntary agreement between a landowner and an organization like a land trust to keep the land from being developed. But that land is still, you know, in private ownership paying taxes. We need to keep that access open, though, and particularly along the coast, we've been losing access that's so vital for clammers, lobstermen, people who want to go kayaking. We have relied, as you suggested earlier, on that tradition of just permissive use, which is wonderful. But that's changing, and we're losing that. And land trusts really play a key role in protecting the key, those critical places for people to get to the water, to make a living, to have some fun, and to live their lives.
Is the reason that we're losing this coastal access because people are buying the property and closing it to access?
Basically, yes.
Yeah, you're nodding as well, Angela.
Yes, and you see that particularly on the coast, but all across Maine, this is true. Places where when we were growing up, you could historically go to snowmobile or hike or go fishing or clamming. When they're bought up by private individuals, oftentimes they close off public access. So it's those of us working in conservation, we see it as a really important priority to think about the places where these traditional access has been allowed and try to secure that public access moving forward. So we partner with other conservation organizations, with our municipalities, with fishermen groups, with many local partners to try to figure out where these traditional access points are and work to conserve those for the future.
All right. Well, we're talking about Maine's coastal islands and its coast and preserving it. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet @MaineCalling, or post to our Facebook page. Tim, tell me about the Maine Coast Heritage Trust campaign, $125 million. You've done it, right? That's a lot of money.
It is a lot of money. One of the challenges we have is that, as probably your listeners know quite well, land along the Maine coast is expensive. To do our work, to acquire those critical pieces of land, and more importantly, to take care of those pieces, because we're basically making a promise to hold those lands in trust for the people of Maine forever. So we want those lands open and available, the trails to be accessible. So the campaign is designed to do just that. We still have a little while left in the campaign, but I'm hopeful, knocking on wood here, that will be done by the end of this year.
Now that you've raised the money, how do you prioritize which islands and which parcels of coastline to save?
That's a great question. Maine has a 3,500-mile-long coastline. So it is not our objective to, quote-unquote, save it all, but we are focused very much on the areas that are the critical access points, key wildlife habitat, places that just protect the, you know, in some senses, because Maine has such a strong reliance on tourism, we also want to protect the places that keep the coast looking the way it does. We have the phrase, keep the coast Maine. Well, that's about keeping it working. It's about keeping it beautiful. It's about keeping it vital and wild. All of those things are part of that effort. So we do a very careful planning effort to focus on where the most important places are. And we also talk to the communities along the coast because we're trying to listen for their needs to fit whatever the conservation is into the needs of local communities, which I think is a critical part of that local control.
Well, and that's what I was going to ask you, Angela. You're not only the chair of the Maine Land Trust Network, but you're part of a local land trust, correct?
And yes.
Topsom?
Yes, Brunswick Topsom Land Trust. I'm the executive director of that organization.
And how do you prioritize? How do you figure out? Do you say, okay, this traditional point of access is something we want to focus on, whether or not it's for sale, whether or not, or do you say, oh, as parcels come up for sale, we're going to think about them? I mean, sort of, what's the thinking process?
I'm going to say the magic is a little bit of both. Mm-hmm. You want to, as a local land trust, to be open to opportunities that come your way and to be able to save spectacular places that you may not have been on your list. But we also do careful planning. We involve a lot of community volunteers and work with our municipalities and other community groups to identify the places in our communities that the citizens really value. So it's about access, but it's also about the places maybe near a school where school kids can get outside and enjoy nature without getting on a bus. Or it's farmland. Is there an active farm that was a really important part of the culture of the community that you want to make sure stays in agriculture? So we work carefully to try to identify places that we proactively reach out to landowners to conserve, but we're also really open to opportunities then come up and try to make that work too.
So tell me a story. Tell me a story about a piece of land that you've preserved that you're really excited about.
Yeah, well, one recent one, because those are always high in your mind, is Woodward Point in Brunswick. Is a almost 90-acre parcel with 2 miles of water frontage on Woodward Cove in the New Meadows River. And in Brunswick, it has been a long-shown community need for more access to the coast, because while we have 67 miles of coast, we don't have a lot of that secured for public access. And we were able to work with the landowner when they were going to transition to sell that property. And we worked in partnership with Maine Coast Heritage Trust, which is a great example of how a larger statewide conservation organization can work with local land trusts to accomplish more together. And we recently, this spring, just conserved this property, and now we're managing it jointly into the future and are thrilled that we're able to bring 2 miles of coastline and some lovely open space to our community.
Okay, Tim, your turn. Tell me about a story of a recent acquisition you're really excited about.
Let me just say it was a real pleasure to work with Angela's Land Trust on that. We were able to bring a lot of dollars to that project from outside of the area. And so we're very excited about the future of that, protecting the water quality in that area. My project that I would that I continue to be excited about is one that we did further down east in the town of Millbridge, where we were approached by a local group that was looking to improve the nutrition of local families, kids particularly. But they didn't have a place that they could actually grow the food they were looking to do in the model that they had. So they came to us, and we helped them buy a 5-acre parcel of land, and now working with the Women's Health Resource Library in Millbridge, we have a community garden, an exercise track, an outdoor play area for kids, and it's all within walking distance of the center of Millbridge. And as a little bit of bonus, it's protecting wetlands along the shore as well. So it's something just enriches the well-being of these communities. And it's the kind of thing, I think, that land trusts, which really are community-supported organizations, it's the kind of thing land trusts excel at.
Well, before we go to a break, I want to get in one call. I'm going to go to Becky, who's calling from North Haven Island. Becky, thanks so much for calling in.
Thanks for taking my call. There are many things that I want to say. It's exciting to hear this program. I haven't heard you move towards the effect of climate change on islands, which I think is a serious problem. I salute land conservation, although we have, on a small islands, we have a problem of tax base, which, I'm sure my assessors would be concerned to hear about. But we also are losing pieces of the island to off of the bluffs, and our wetlands are, not being preserved. And I would really like to see how we can find a way to make it possible to, have community sustainability in terms of, tax base, but also preserve wetlands as a way of elasticity for, sea level rise, et cetera. So I guess I'll take my answer off, on
the radio. Becky. Yeah, you've just asked two of the big questions of the hour, I think, tax implications and climate change. Go ahead, Tim.
Becky, that is such a good question. And bless you for calling in from North Haven. Climate change is probably the biggest single challenge that the Maine coast faces in the decades ahead. It is going to be imperative that we protect the sensitive spots along the coast. What we are doing, working with a lot of partners, is we're looking to identify those coastal wetlands that Becky was mentioning and looking to see both conserving the wetlands themselves, because they have important ecological function to protect a lot of important things that we depend upon, but also to protect the lands right around them so that as sea level rises, those plant communities have an opportunity to migrate inland as sea level rises. And that's going to be really essential if we're going to keep Maine resilient and really strong in the face of the changes to come.
Angela, I'm going to let you talk about the other part of Becky's question, which is about taking land off of tax rolls. Very sensitive, I'm sure, in most of the communities that have land trusts.
Yes, it's an issue that every project that we do as a local land trust, it's a consideration. And every project has a different answer. Every land is different. The uses are different. For instance, when we conserve Crystal Spring Farm in Brunswick, we own a 320-acre farm. We lease it to a farmer, so it continues in active agriculture. So we continue to pay taxes on that as any farmer would. We pay about $12,000 in taxes. But there are other properties that we conserve in partnership with the municipalities. We're helping the towns accomplish the goals of their comprehensive plans. And it's really seen as a partnership. And the land trust brings a lot to the table in raising funds to acquire the land and taking on the expenses of managing it into the future. And what the municipalities bring to the table is they will agree to exempt us from paying taxes. Sometimes we do something in the middle and we keep it on the tax roll, but we apply for open space. So every project is a partnership with the town in which we conserve the property. And we work really hard, and most land trusts do, to make sure that we come to a careful agreement that meets the benefits of the town in the towns in which we work. And on the larger scale, and Tim may prefer to talk to this, it's important to note that 95% of the lands that are conserved by land trusts in the state of Maine are still on the tax roll. Tim mentioned easements before. Those are still privately owned. The landowner pays taxes. So most lands are still on the tax rolls. It is important for people to understand that.
All right. Well, we are going to take a quick break. When we come back, your comments and questions, more of your comments and questions. We're talking about preserving Maine's coast and Maine's islands. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Cumberland Crossing, a new retirement community offering access to Ocean View at Falmouth's Care Continuum. CumberlandCrossingRC.com and Maine Community Foundation, where you can create your own charitable fund to benefit Maine. Learn more at MaineCF.org.
In a remote hospital in 1976, a Congolese doctor collected the first sample of the Ebola virus. He didn't get much credit.
A lot of the history of Ebola has been written without your name in it.
Yes, but it is not correct.
Now he's leading Congo's Ebola response. That story this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That's coming up today between 4 and 6:30 here on Maine Public Radio. Maine Public is very pleased to be a media sponsor of the February 2020 Camden Conference. The conference theme is The Media Revolution, Changing the World, and will be moderated by Marketplace Morning Report's David Brancaccio. Tickets to the Camden Conference go on sale December 2nd. However, Maine Public members can purchase tickets in advance now. Go to mainpublic.org for all the details and click on events.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, we're talking about Maine's coastal islands and coastline and what's being done to protect it. Joining me, Tim Glidden, who is president of the Maine Coast Heritage Trust, and Angela Twitchell, chair of the Maine Land Trust Network. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainpublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. On the line with us now is Suzanne McDonald, who is Chief Community Development Officer with the Island Institute. Suzanne, thanks for giving us a call.
Hey, thanks so much for having me. It's nice to be a part of the discussion.
Yeah, tell us about the work Island Institute is doing to help communities become more resilient in the face of climate change.
Sure. Just so folks are familiar, the Island Institute is a community development nonprofit based in Rockland. We've been around for about 36 years. And many people know that we partner with the 15 year-round island communities here in Maine, but we are also increasingly recognizing the linkages between the islands and the mainland. And so now we're working in 120 communities along the coast as well. We so appreciate the work of Maine Coast Heritage Trust and those on the call today. Land accessibility, access to the working waterfront is so critically important for the viability and ability of our coastal communities to thrive. The primary focus of our work at the Island Institute is really around building capacity within these communities, whether that's at the town office or within small businesses or at schools or on the waterfront. Really to be able to respond to the increasing number of pressures that we're feeling and seeing on the coast and on the islands due to climate change and challenges within our economy. 75% of Maine's coastal communities have fewer than 3,500 people. And of our coastal communities have fewer than 800 people. And so that's really where our work comes in at the Island Institute, is trying to be an extra set of hands, trying to bring some technical assistance to the table and help to build networks to connect communities to each
other.
Suzanne,
your call dropped out for just a second. What percentage have less than 800?
Sure. 25% of Maine's coastal communities have less than 800 people living in them.
Let me ask you this. The Island Institute, I understand, is about to release a report on infrastructure for Maine's coast and islands. What are some of the most interesting findings?
Sure. Waypoints is our community indicators publication. This will be the third edition. We're trying to bring the best available information about island and coastal economies and communities to the forefront. This upcoming edition is called Connect, and it's focusing on the physical, economic, and civic infrastructure that's connecting our small communities. We're going to be taking a look at an updated look at working waterfront access along the coast, looking at ways in which we heat our homes along the coast and how that's shifting, and also taking a look at the economic significance of our coastal
ports. We're looking at broadband, and we've realized that for about a third of our coast, there really isn't a great business case for building out broadband infrastructure, which is a key way in which we can make our coastal communities more resilient and diverse. And so it's really helping to point to the fact that we'll need some state or local support in order to build out infrastructure in certain parts of the coast.
Tim.
Well, I'm just so pleased to be hearing this. Suzanne, it's great to hear your voice. What you're hearing here is a wonderful example of how all, you know, the good things that happen in Maine happen through partnerships. So as the Island Institute is working in these community development avenues that she has been describing so well, the work that the land trusts are doing is providing the lands that provides that sort of wraparound context for these communities. And, you know, it's the strength of Maine's coast and the people and the communities there really comes from that relationship between people and land. And so I'm very pleased. MCHT has worked in the past a number of times with Island Institute and look forward to future.
All right. Well, Suzanne, thanks so much for calling in. That was Suzanne McDonald, Chief Community Development Officer with the Island Institute. And on the line with us now is Sarah Demers. She is Director of the Land for Maine's Future Program with the State's Department of Agriculture, Conservation, and Forestry. Sarah, thanks for giving us a call.
Well, I'm really pleased to be here today, Jennifer.
Tell me about what Land for Maine's Future, what the state is doing in terms of coast and island conservation.
Sure. You know, over the last year, the state has really been ramping up its efforts, looking at tools and strategies to help prioritize coastal and island conservation efforts. A couple of examples of that include the Bureau of Parks and Lands recently published State Comprehensive Outdoor Recreation Plan, which is out there and available for public comment. And I think one of the interesting findings relevant to today's discussion is that surveys undertaken by the Bureau indicate that the public is really eager for more opportunities for coastal recreation and access for swimming. Another initiative is the Department of Inland Fisheries and Wildlife is working to identify priority strategies for at-risk coastal and marine species and their habitats through the State Wildlife Action Plan. So that's a sampling of a couple of different efforts that are underway, and I think as those efforts begin to mature, you'll start to hear more about concrete on-the-ground actions. We do have, you know, coastal geologists meeting with towns to assist them in understanding threats and how important that municipal planning process is in preparing for sea level rise. From LMF's perspective, we've just started to think about how sea level rise plays into our prioritization of coastal projects. We'll be reviewing priorities from the last 20 years, which includes coastal islands and coastal access, thinking about what we've been able to accomplish in the past and then where we might want to tweak priorities moving forward. And I think that's a really exciting place for us to be right now.
All right. Well, thank you so much. That is Sarah Demers, Director of the Land for Maine's Future Program. I'm going to go to a question from Kimberly on Facebook. She says, please explain how land trusts are funded.
Well, that's a great question, Kimberly. As Tim mentioned, we really are a product of the support that we get from our communities. So we, for instance, the Brunswick Topsom Land Trust, where I work, we have about 1,000 members who contribute to us annually. Some of them give us $10, some of them give us more, but we are a product of that community support. So we work really hard to address the needs of our communities and to be valued in our communities. And all of our fundraising for our annual operating support comes from the generosity of our supporters. We also do write grants when we're working on land projects or initiating new projects. We are grant funded from private foundations as well as federal and state grant sources, but it's really through the support of our local communities that we're able to do our work.
Yeah, I would just expand on that and say, or agree with that principally, you know, all of our operating support is coming from generous private gifts. And even in the land acquisition or the land conservation work that we're doing, while the public funding for that is crucial, the majority, in fact, the vast majority of the funding is also coming from private gifts. So the public, it's another way that land trusts are really complementing the work that that towns and state government can't afford to do by drawing in this additional private gifts.
And when you say private gifts, you mean money and land, right?
Money and land, yes. Yeah. Money and land.
We have an email from Betta. My sense is that the Maine coast is becoming harder and harder to access by anyone other than the wealthy. How is Maine Coast Heritage Trust working to protect access to working people and those of us who just want to recreate on the shore?
Well, it's, as we've been talking about it, this is a critical question for the Maine, for Maine as a whole, and certainly access on the coast is limited and diminishing. We basically go out there and try to buy the critical places that will give people access to the coast. Sometimes we turn those over and we give them to towns so they have that control themselves. Sometimes we hold it ourselves, and I would encourage anybody who's looking for opportunities to get out onto the coast to hit MCHT's Maine Coast Heritage Trust website, and you'll see more than 100 different preserves that you can get to. But what we do is we get out there and we round it up and we get it into a public trust.
We'll go to Michael calling from Scarborough. Hi, Michael. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Michael. Good afternoon. Good afternoon, Jennifer and Tim and Angela. I appreciate the opportunity to chat with you today. As a longtime fan of the Maine coast, both kayaking, canoeing, sailing, what have you, one of the things I've noticed is the Boston effect, which is to say that as population has moved north, I continue to have to migrate further north in Maine to access some of the wild places that have been so wonderful, you know, for myself, but also for my children. And so I'm wondering, how do you feel about the tension of, I'm reminded of the five-man electric band 1970s release of Signs, right? Signs, signs, everywhere there's signs, blocking out my scenery, taking up time. I'm not going to sing, but, you know, how do we manage the tension of keeping Maine wild, keeping Maine accessible, while at the same time recognizing we have population that's sort of growing up this way. And by the way, I'm a huge fan of the work you do. I just have been frozen out of 3 or 4 of my favorite spots.
You've described the problem very, very well, and we've been talking about here. I think what we need to be doing is we need to be staying ahead of the influx of folks coming in both seasonally and year-round. We're going to be seeing a lot more of that in the decades ahead. So the work that Angela's organization and ours are doing is to get ahead of that curve. We need to acquire those places. We need to work with those local communities to identify the key pieces of land that they feel really define the character of their town. When we do that, everybody's happy.
Michael, thanks for your call. An email here from Robin. Now that private landowners, including land trusts, own the seaweed on their shores by a 2019 Maine court decision, one of the most important conservation benefits that land trusts can offer is to conserve seaweed habitat on the coast by saying no to rockweed harvest. Declining shorebird populations to juvenile fish to lobster all benefit from that conserved seaweed habitat, while traditional clamming and worming go on as part of legally established public trust rights on the shore. How does this 2019 decision, this decision from this year about the intertidal zone, affect the work that you do, Tim?
Well, the decision that Robin described accurately does clearly define the ownership rights in the intertidal zone. So basically, the rockweed that is growing in those areas is owned by the upland landowner in the same way that that owner owns the trees growing on their property. I think we are in a period of a bit of flux because there was quite a bit of debate before this decision came down. And I think that there's going to be a period of time in which we're working out basically how this is going to happen. MCHT wants to have the ecological functions of the coast remain intact. So obviously we are concerned about rockweed harvesting. At the same time, we also are very much in favor of a working coast. And so we want to be doing what we can to ensure that both the ecological functions and the working aspects of the coast are compatible.
All right. Is there anything you want to add to that, Angela?
The only thing that I would add is the decision is forcing a lot of local land trusts to think about this and come up with policies that try to work out that balance, right? There's balance between ecological habitat protection and encouraging working waterfront. And the state of Maine is also looking into this. So it's a discussion that is out there, and we're all striving to find the best answer for that.
All right. Well, if you'd like to join this conversation about preserving islands and Maine's coast, give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, be quick with your email, make it brief, talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. I'm going to throw out a trivia question before we go to break, and I'm going to have Tim answer it when we come back. And that question is, what is the most common Maine island name? It may not be what you think. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Evergreen Home Performance, offering energy-efficient windows and insulation to help homeowners achieve year-round comfort. More at evergreenyourhome.com. And St. Lawrence Arts in Portland, hosting legendary guitarist Albert Lee on January 20th. More information at stlawrencearts.org.
Hello, I'm Jane Wales, host of World Affairs. At age 22, Amaryllis Fox became one of the CIA's youngest female officers. In her 8 years overseas, she worked undercover to stop acts of terrorism and the illegal sale of arms and explosives. Next on World Affairs, Fox, who is now working as a peace activist, will join us to share her story and give insights into the secretive world of the CIA.
That's coming up today at 2 here on Maine Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Saeed Jones talks about his new memoir, How We Fight for Our Lives, about growing up black, gay, and closeted in Texas in the era when he thought gay meant AIDS meant death. Our book critic Maureen Carrigan describes the memoir as raw and eloquent. I hope you'll join us.
And that's coming up this evening at 7 here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, what can be done to protect Maine islands from environmental damage and other threats? Joining me, Angela Twitchell with the Maine Land Trust Network and Tim Glidden with Maine Coast Heritage Trust. Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. Before we went to break, I threw out a trivia question. I think that's the first time I've done that on Maine Calling. What is the most common Maine island name? When somebody threw this at me, I got it wrong. My guess was Long Island. It's not even on the top five list. So, Tim, drumroll, please. What is the most common island name in Maine?
Well, the most common island name in Maine is Ram Island. We have one right here in the greater Portland area, but that really is a reflection of the history of using islands to keep those obstreperous rams separate from the rest of the flock, and a long history of sheep herding in Maine.
So what else are common island names in Maine? Oh, and by the way, how many Ram Islands are there?
Oh, my gosh. I think there are 35 is the count that we have, and that could be off. but we have about 35. Other common names would include the ever-imaginative Green Island, along with Crow Island and, of course, Bar or Barred Island, because we have many, many islands that are connected at low tide by a bar.
All right. That's great. We'll go to Kai in Phippsburg. Hi, Kai. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Yes. Good afternoon. I am calling from Phippsburg, and Phippsburg has 90 miles of coastline. It has the largest amount of nature preserve land of all the communities in Maine, but we have only one boat ramp on the Kennebec River, a main boat ramp, and two secondary ones, one on the New Meadows River and one down by West Point. The one public boat ramp is 15 miles from the ocean and very hard to find. So, and there's more than enough coastline, as I just said. So I don't know where to go from here, but...
Okay, so you're looking for not just preserving the land, but providing a way to get onto the water.
You're right. Yeah, I mean, Pompano Beach is the most visited state park in Maine, and well, no place to get at it.
This is your neck of the woods, Angela, right down the road.
Yeah, and it's a really common need, you know, for both drive-in access for boats as well as hand carry for canoes and kayaks. They're all really popular activities on the coast of Maine. It's one of the highest priorities that we have, and I know that other coastal land trusts share it. I would say you should call your local land trust, the Phippsburg Land Trust, or call your town, and often towns and land trusts work together to secure more access, and good luck to you. It's a beautiful spot.
Just a quick addition to that, we had Sarah Demers on the program just a moment ago. Sarah would be happy, to provide information on the water access program that LMF runs.
Land
for Maine's Future, thank you. That if the town of Phippsburg was interested in acquiring a site, the state could provide some of the help to do that.
There you go, Kai. We'll move on. We'll go to Nancy, who's calling from Southport Island. Hi, Nancy. Go ahead.
Good afternoon. I appreciate you taking my call. I represent Land for Southport's Future. And we are working, as Tim said earlier, to stay ahead of that curve. We do not want to see our community and the visitors who come to the Booth Bay region frozen out of that land access. So many of the key points that y'all have mentioned are really critical to our program. We will have about 2.5 acres of natural land. There's watershed. There's the marshland. It's the marshland that raised the monarch butterflies that Rachel Carson then used as part of her studies. And it's the land that inspired her to write Silent Spring. Ruth's house itself, we're working with Island Institute through our broadband community, through Georgetown, Arasic, and Southport, to, with some support from Island Institute, to see if we can't make Ruth's house a technology hub. And last week at the broadband conference, I had a chance to talk about the projects that they're doing through Island Institute to connect the schools, the island schools, and we would be able as an island to contribute to that project. So we've got many, many points in the air there. But we've got 345 households that are supporting us. We're a 501c3. But, Tim, we need partners. Partners are the hardest part of a project like this to bring together. And so I toss it out there that we'd like to be on your map.
Southport Island.
Thank you, Nancy. The partnerships really are the important pieces, and the strongest partners really do come locally. So that's, you know, what we find is when we're working in any community, that's the strongest partnerships you can possibly have.
And I would say, Nancy, with my Maine Land Trust Network hat on, I would love to hear from you because you may find a lot of support in that group. It's a statewide network where all of about 84 land trusts get together. We share resources. We share information. And best practices, and that may help you in some ways. You may learn some things, and we would love to have you connected to that network. If people are interested, they can go to mltn.org, and it's also a great place to find all the land trusts in the state. And if you're looking for new places to get outside, you can click on a land trust in your area and find preserves you may never heard of, and you can find places that maybe are less crowded and less known than the other more popular spots.
Nancy, thanks for your call. We'll move on to Chris calling from East Machias. Hi, Chris. Go ahead.
Oh, I just wanted to say that the coast of Maine is uniquely beautiful. And I just want to say thank you, Tim and Angela, for doing what you can to help preserve it. And especially in Washington County, and my favorite place is on the Bold Coast. I've been going there for 37 years. Also a great view of Grand Manan. Of course, one of our great American writers had a cabin out there, and that's Willa Cather. So thank you.
Thanks, Chris.
Thank you, Chris. It's great to get a shout-out from East Machias. It's an incredible place, lots of good work being done there. And Washington County is definitely one of the places that people really understand the connection between their well-being and the land.
Yeah. Chris, the Gold Coast is just, if people have not been there, it's really worth the trip, and it gets you a little bit out of the fray, and it's spectacular.
It is. Chris, thank you for calling. I want to go to an email here from David. David writes, my family has 2 small islands, 1 acre and 5 acres, off the coast of Friendship. They've been occupied for generations in the lobster industry and now for recreation. Both will be diminished or eliminated with rising sea levels. A lobsterman's daughter in her 60s reminds us that sea level has risen about a foot in her lifetime. We now see a monthly 6-inch flood at high tide of a walkway on our smaller island. Our smaller island, as well as most piers and waterfront parking lots in Friendship, will be underwater at high tide within my adult children's lifetime.
We are definitely seeing those challenges happening now. Suzanne from Island Institute was alluding to some work that the Island Institute is funding in many communities looking at this problem and trying to help towns get ready for it. But we are expecting significant sea level rises over the next 80 to 100 years, and we're going to be seeing a lot of coastal flooding. We need to be ready for that.
An email from Bob. I grew up in Florida during the 1950s and 60s. When I was a child, most of the coast of Florida was wild, beautiful, pristine, and undeveloped. Between the time of my childhood and becoming an adult, most of the coastline was sold to private landowners, and this land was, within a few years, completely developed and covered with high-rise condos, gated communities, and hotels with access to the public forbidden. As someone who considers Maine my adopted home, I would urge all Mainers to push state and local governments to quickly acquire or put into trust our most precious resources. What happened in Florida can happen here very quickly. And Tim, I know you wanted to speak to the benefits of land conservation. I suspect Bob just summed it up pretty well.
He summed it up quite well. I mean, we here in Maine know how good we've got it in a lot of ways. The lands of Maine, particularly the coast of Maine, is a spectacular asset, and it really enhances our lives. If we don't take care of it, if we don't plan for those future challenges, just like he described, we'll lose that. So complacency, I think, is our biggest enemy. In terms of benefits, though, when I think about that, you know, we have our tourism economy heavily dependent on the coastal, the quality of the coastal landscapes. We have working lands and working waterfronts all up and down the coast and throughout the state. Lots of the land that land conservation, the vast majority of the land that land trusts have conserved is open for hunting, bird watching, all kinds of recreation. So in many, many ways, the benefits of land conservation really are pervasive, and they really lift up all aspects of society.
We'll go to Alex on Facebook. I'm a fourth-year senior civil engineering student at the University of Maine. My group's project is working on a conservation easement around the Bucksport area. It should be known that our project is strictly for academic purposes. We are in a project management phase now, and next semester is the execution or design phase. My question is, what are some good resources that are available as an interested individual or someone working for a conservation trust to obtain information that could help with recreational, trail, permitting, and other types of steps to start this process after obtaining the land easement? Angela, resources, yes. You?
I love to get a call from a college student, particularly UMaine Engineering, where my son is a freshman. I would say there are lots of great resources. You could start with your local land trust. I know there are some in Bangor and Orono. If you go to the Maine Land Trust Network website, you can find all of those local land trusts, and I can tell you any of them would be thrilled to talk to a college student about easements and easement managements. There's also a great website, Land Trust Alliance, I think it's LTA.org, where there's tons of resources and a whole library on easements, almost anything you could know about them. And I would offer, you could feel free to contact me, because it's a passion of mine is getting young people involved in caring about conservation, because you guys are our future.
All right. Well, thank you so much for that. An email from Dave. Can your guests comment on whether islands are seeing more use or less use in recent years? Are there any problems we should be aware of?
I would say we are seeing more use in the southern Maine islands. We happen to have acquired a couple of islands in Casco Bay, particularly the Goslings, which was a well-known spot and very popular before we protected it, but has become in some ways even more popular since. The Maine Island Trail Association is a wonderful group that also has been providing access through its island trail information that they put out. And I would say that we are seeing more use. I wouldn't say we're necessarily seeing more problems generally, although I'm sure there's some local hotspots where there are some.
Okay. We'll go to Daniel calling from Dayton. Hi, Daniel. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm a chair of the board of the trustees of the Maine Island Trail Association, and it's a timely call to give a shout out to MCHT and other land trusts for important partners for MIDA. MIDA established a water trail about 30 years ago, and now it's 370 miles long with over 220 sites for camping and day use, and many of those are land trust sites. About 50 are privately owned islands, and MIDA doesn't directly conserve land and have relied on MCHT and others to secure islands to address generational transfer. Families that decide they want to sell islands that have been on the trail. I had the pleasure to collaborate directly with MCHT on conserving one of the many Ram Islands, this one in Machias Bay, a really special place that has rare plants and have been used historically for running sheep and for recreation, and just one of my favorite spots. MCHT staff were fun and competent and kept their promises, and we were able to fundraise collectively and purchase the island and preserve it. So hoping for more collaboration in the future. These places do enhance our lives.
Daniel, well, thanks for your call.
Thanks for the shout-out, Daniel. Looking forward to those. Looking forward to more of that as well. And I love hearing people talk about their special places along the Maine coast. There are so many of these spots. They are really, really special. And we're looking to make sure that, all of us and our kids have access to those in the future.
All right. Well, we'll try to squeeze in one more call. Peter, if you could be quick, that'd be great.
Hello. How are you?
Good. Go ahead.
Good. Okay. So I will be quick. I actually grew up here in my younger years, moved away, and then moved back because I know how much I missed Maine. So my comment, as you were talking about access to property, I think I jumped in the middle of your show. But as you were talking about access to property, I believe there is still, unless it's been changed, a law in Maine that has existed since it was part of Massachusetts that it allows access to coastal property, any coastal property, for the means of hunting, fishing, and navigation. I also would like to know and hear some comments if you or any of your panel has any information of whether other people are trying to expand that into aquaculture.
Yeah, Peter, that this is something not to ask at the end of the program, unfortunately for you, but the beginning, a whole big Maine court decision happened this year that had to do with the intertidal zone. But if you, in a few seconds, Tim, could just sum up where we stand.
Well, where we stand right now is that the public does have access within the intertidal zone, the so-called wet sand. You can get on that, but you have to, for fishing, fowling, or navigation. In other words, shooting ducks, whatever. But you have to, you cannot cross somebody's land to get
there.
That.
You have to come by boat.
You got to come by boat.
Peter, thanks for your call. And thank you to both of our guests today. The voice you just heard, Tim Glidden, president of the Maine Coast Heritage Trust. Also here with us, Angela Twitchell, the chair of the Maine Land Trust Network. Lucy Suchek ran the board today. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.